You all are going to love my guest today. His name is Luke Story, and I can tell you this, he has an incredible story. So you are in for a treat today. As a matter of fact, he is known as the Lifestylist and actually has a podcast such, and we'll make sure we give you the link to his podcast. I was actually on his podcast and enjoyed my time there, and Luke and I met. I believe it was the Bulletproof Conference, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's funny, Dan, about that recording that we did. You know, for those listening, we recorded it in the green room at the Bulletproof Conference. And there was, I mean, maybe, I don't know, 80 people running around there. It was really loud. And we did a great interview. It was very focused and concise. And then I was really concerned that the sound was going to stuck because
I was.
But I swear to God, you could not hear anyone in the background. It sounded like we're in a studio. So not only did the recording come out good, but people loved your episode. So thanks again for coming on. It was very popular episode and very well received. People really got it.
And I appreciate you being on. You have a lot to share today. And you know what? Wow, what a story you have, Luke Story. I said that was a little pun there, but I couldn't help myself. You know, when you look at the Lifestylist, people understand that more because you were the celebrity stylist for 17 years. I mean, I think most of my viewers would understand Aerosmith, Ozzy Osbourne, right? Kim Kardashian. There, I picked up the younger generation.
Yeah.
Fighters. Okay, there's a long list of stars that you were the stylist for. So, okay. I mean, with that said, how in the world did you end up here? Now, you have an amazing story because you were a heroin addict, right? If I'm not correct, alcohol and crack addict at age 26. And dude, look at you now, man. You are a world changer. You really are. So I'm just going to bust right into it, man. You've got to tell that story from that for the stylist to the addict, you know, to that. And I want you to talk a little bit about addiction because, you know, I'll tell you, man, this is an area that I think needs more attention today, especially with the younger generation. So we're going to tap into that today on this show. And we're also going to tap into some really cool biohacking for those of us who live in cities. You know, listen, Luke's got some cool answers. We're going to talk about that. But Luke, we got to bust right into your story, man, because that's it's an incredible one. Go ahead.
I love telling my story because it's one I never get sick of, you know, maybe either because I'm narcissistic or just because it's a great story. But it really is a hero's journey, man. You know, my parents divorced when I was really young, and I went with mom, and the environment growing up with her, which was in Northern California, was, you know, we lived in really low income areas and not money. There was a lot of crime and drugs. It was in Northern California in the 70s, and a lot of the hippies from Haight-Ashbury migrated into Sonoma County and became bikers and drug addicts, and it was not a healthy environment, and I experienced a fair amount of trauma and abuse and things like that as a kid, as a really young kid. And I think just as a convergence of the trauma I experienced and the early exposure to that drug culture, I got really heavily involved in drugs, and that was kind of my medicine. And I self-medicated. There wasn't an abundance of therapy and the things that are available now. If you were a screwed up kid, it was looked at more as just that you had disciplinary problems and that you were a juvenile delinquent and you were sort of just put in special classes and tucked away. And my way of coping with the shame that I experienced and, you know, just the way that I felt different than the other kids, and I just never really fit in and just had all these problems in school and learning. And I don't know that I officially had a learning disability, but I definitely didn't learn.
I did.
In the way in which the schools at that time were teaching. You know, I couldn't sit in my seat. I just, you know,
listen, I was a dyslexic. So a lot of my wounds and traumas, I mean, literally stemmed from that, you know, but I have to say it's, you know, part of the reason why I'm able to help the people I help. You know, my son is ADD and dyslexic, and he is the kid that you just spoke of, you know, and we live in Park City, Utah, so we get a lot of California influence here, man. And, you know, I can tell you, my kids remind me, Dad, you know, it's, you know, most of the kids, you know, or it's very rare that a kid's not doing drugs, and it is the California influence. So I feel that right here personally. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it's much worse now. I'm like terrified to have kids because of the kind of kid I was, you know. But anyway, you know, fast forwarding, I just, you know, that was my coping mechanism. And so I became horribly addicted to drugs at a really young age, 8, 9 years old. I started doing not only just like smoking pot, like maybe some experimental kids would, but doing really hard drugs, and was lucky enough to get a break from that for 2 years. I was having problems with the law, and I got arrested and sent away to this school in Idaho. And so I cleaned up for a couple of years in there. Luckily, I got a glimpse at some personal development and you know, psychology, and was in group therapy and things like that. And it straightened me up for a couple of years, but I got out in 1986 and proceeded to just go back downhill again. Moved to Hollywood when I was 19 and wanted to be a musician. So I started playing in bands, and in the late 80s, early 90s, Hollywood was even more decrepit than it is now, if you can imagine that. And I got really caught up in the underworld of just the Hollywood drug scene, and had some fun and did my little music thing and all of that, but it ultimately just became completely dysfunctional and just an absolute wreck of a human being. And by the time I was 26, that had all come to a head. And it's not that, you know, I ended up getting beat up or arrested or in the hospital. I just reached this point of just inner turmoil that was so great that I made the decision to check myself into a treatment center. I did that at 26 years old. It was in 1997. And that's when I was introduced into the world of recovery and, you know, an open-minded sort of approach to spirituality. And that was kind of when my journey began. And that was 21 years ago now. And what happened for me and how it relates to kind of biohacking and health and all of that was that I, you know, realized pretty quickly that A, that I was very toxic, speaking of what you do with the detoxing and all right. that. And so physically I had a lot of cleansing to do, but I also just had a lot of soul cleansing to do, man. I was so full of anger and anxiety and self-hatred and other hatred. And I was so insecure and self-conscious, and just, I had no coping skills because the way that I had coped with life and my emotions and all of that up until 26 was by just numbing everything constantly with the drugs that you mentioned and a few other ones. So mm-hmm. here I am 26, I pop out of rehab and I have the, you know, the emotional intelligence of a 10-year-old, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So
I've got this physical toxicity where I'm still just pouring, you know, drug residue out of my every pore of my body, and then having to really find, you know, meditation and a spiritual approach to life. And so
yeah.
Then began the process of purifying myself, essentially. And that's kind of what I've been doing for the past 21 years, is really refining the mind, body, spirit approach to healing. And
yeah,
you know, I always say that you can't have one without the other. So I could have gotten physically clean, done some fasting, some colonics, whatever the, you know, the juice cleanses and the things that were in vogue in the mid 90s. I could have done all that, but still been full of anger.
Yeah.
Or I could have gone to therapy and worked on my anger and, you know, anxiety and depression and all of those things, but still be eating McDonald's and then fall apart physically. So I started to piece together what now is, you know, was the core of the lifestyle that I lead and help other people discover now.
Yeah. And I want to talk about some of that, but you know, I brought up these names in the beginning, and I'm sure my viewers are like, please ask him more about, like, how did he end up being the stylist to the stars? You even started your own stylist school. I mean, that's
sure,
all.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but I got to hear a little bit about, you know, I mean,
no problem.
Aerosmith, Ozzy Osbourne. I mean, okay, how did you go from the addict to that? I mean, my gosh, I mean, you really put your life together. And how did you find that? I mean, obviously, you're massively gifted there. I mean, but what was that transition like? And what was that like doing that?
Good question. I'm glad I sometimes forget about that part of the story because it was miraculous. You know what? It was a lot of it was just destiny, fate, karma, luck. What happened was when I was 26 and I got out of that treatment center and I started to work on myself and do the things that I continue to do today, I had this one lucky break, and that was really the catalyst for my career that would go on to last 17 years working in Hollywood. And what happened was I had an old friend who named Kikai Mingus, who is incidentally the daughter of famed jazz musician Charles Mingus, which is just an interesting side note. And I had met her, and she taught me a lot about music and pop culture and art and fashion and things like that. And we dated briefly when I was in my early 20s, and then she ended that because I was such a screw-up, basically. But what happened, and she was considerably older than me, but what happened was when I got sober, she, you know, I reached out to her and said, hey, you know, by the way, I got sober and just kind of caught up with her. And she was, and I happened to be homeless at the time, not like sleeping under the freeway, but just bouncing from place to place. I was newly sober. I had,
right.
You know, I had given up my apartment because it was just, it was a bad environment in that building and stuff. And I didn't want to fall back into my old ways. So it just so happened that she was going on tour with Tina Turner because she was a stylist, a fashion stylist.
Okay.
Somebody who dresses celebrities and models and things like that. Some people don't even know what a stylist is. They think you're a designer. So just to clarify that, a fashion designer is someone who designs and manufactures and makes clothes for people. Yeah. A stylist is somebody who shops for clothes and dresses people. So that is a distinction that might be useful. So she said, listen, I'm going to be gone the whole summer on tour. I need someone to house it for me and watch my dog. And so she had me do that. And while she was gone, I mean, I literally almost killed her dog. I almost burned the, I'm not even exact. I mean, the story, there's too long of a story, but I almost killed the dog. I almost burned the apartment down. It was just a complete disaster. But she came back in town, and because she had just moved to LA and she didn't know anyone, I was literally the only person she knew here. She came back in town and she booked Aerosmith as a client. And she kind of looked around and was like, wow, I need an assistant. The only person I know is this knucklehead that's been destroying my apartment for 3 months. And but I had been doing, you know, some errands for her and kind of acting as a quasi-assistant, you know, right. As screwed up as I was, just because I was brain dead from all the drugs quite often. She booked Aerosmith and was kind of just in a jam. And so she hired me because she was just forced to out of her circumstances. So here I am like 6 months out of rehab. I can literally barely tie my shoes. I've got this 1982 Toyota Tercel that I'm cruising around in. I mean, I had no money. I had nowhere to live. And I'm like, now I'm hanging out working for Aerosmith. You know, it was a really strange experience, especially because I was a musician also. I was playing in bands, and Aerosmith, you know, I grew up in the 70s, as I said, but Aerosmith was everything. So it was a very surreal experience.
Yeah.
What makes the story even more interesting, and someday I hope to interview Steven Tyler on my show. He's one of my like top 10 guests.
Right? Yeah, he's cool.
Because Aerosmith were publicly sober at that time, and that's when kind of being sober was, to me at least, was very uncool, and it was something that wasn't talked about a lot, and celebrities weren't publicly admitting that they were having issues in that area, let alone saying, hey, it's really cool to go to rehab and be sober. I thought it was really square. I thought that people that were sober were nerds and losers, and I didn't think that that was cool at all. I wanted to have tattoos and be in a band and do my Hollywood thing. So when I got hired by her and I got to spend some time with Steven Tyler and the guys in that band, and I saw that they were really successful, they were wealthy, they were famous, they were super cool, and they were also sober, it was really inspiring to me.
Mm.
I remember having a conversation with Steven Tyler one day, and just, you know, my boss was so cool. She knew I was a big fan, but I always played it cool. And, didn't, you know, I didn't want to be like a super fan around them. So I acted professional. And I didn't really talk to him. I kind of just tied their shoes and fixed their suit and didn't really look them in the eyes. You know, I was very insecure and shy at the same time. But she invited me over one day to Steven Tyler's bungalow at the hotel. And she said, he's got a day off today. You should come over and hang out with us. You know, and I went and we drank like O'Doul's non-alcoholic beers.
Yeah.
Just got to hang out for a couple hours, and I asked him, just, you know, what's it like to be sober, and how do you play in a band, and how do you write songs and go in the studio and do the stuff you do? Because the only way I knew how to access my creativity was through drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And he explained to me how he did it, and that in fact, you think that it's the drugs and alcohol that are assisting you in the creativity, but really what eventually happens when it turns on you is it actually kills your creativity.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And that we look at people like Jimi Hendrix and think he was Jimi Hendrix because of the LSD. No, he was Jimi Hendrix because he was Jimi Hendrix. And ultimately, look what happened to him as a result. His creativity was not only stopped, so was his life.
So what was the advice he gave you? I mean,
it's funny because I've pondered that and I've tried to remember what it was that he said. But it's funny because I think sometimes people at that level, they're a little bit out of touch for what it's like for just your average person on the street. And he said something to the effect, he's like, man, if I get stressed out, I go to my place in Maui and I just hike to the top of a mountain and I meditate, you know, and here I am 26, practically living in my 82 Tercel. Like, that's great for you, dude. But, like,
well, what about getting his creativity though, man? I mean, like, you know, so how was he doing that? So he obviously tapped back into his real creativity. Did he give you any pointers there? Because that's the question you asked him. You were searching for that answer.
Well, to be honest, it was quite a long time ago, so I don't remember the conversation for
Dave.
But I do remember the Hawaii comment, which is a little unattainable.
Right.
Not that useful at that stage in my life. But what did stick with me in terms of, you know, being in a band and creating and being successful was that he also had, I remember he said, well, I got Joe Perry right next to me on stage, man. So, if I'm having a hard time performing or accessing that creativity, I know I've got someone there who's on the same path, because Joe Perry was also so, they used to be called the Toxic Twins in the 70s because they were so drug addled, you know? And so I got the connection that you need to be around other people that are on the same path and on the same wavelength. And so what I did, I really took that advice and I started playing in bands with other guys that were also in recovery and achieved over the years, you know, varying degrees of success. I never made it to where Aerosmith were, but I did get to go on tour and travel to Europe a few times and do some cool things in bands that your listeners would probably never have heard of. But that was how I got into fashion. And then fast forward through the next, you know, like I said, 17 years to follow, I worked my way up the ranks, working as an assistant under other stylists as I finished out, and then eventually started booking my own clients. And, you know, next thing you know, here I am 15 years after that, and I'm Marilyn Manson's stylist, or working with the Foo Fighters, or Kanye West, or Kim Kardashian, or any of these people, and that was kind of my day job.
Yeah.
So that's how that weirdness sort of happened. And I also played music for a considerable period of time while I was also a stylist. And I looked at the styling thing as kind of my day job, and then music was the dream, you know?
Yeah.
And eventually I just kind of lost interest in the pursuit of music, because I always say, like, the thing about playing in a band that sucks is you have to be in a band with other musicians. It's like, you know, going on tour with a bunch of smelly guys in a band sounds cool until you actually do it.
And then, yeah.
Oh, this sucks. And I was really into health. And so when I would go on tour, I mean, I was a vegetarian at the time, and we were traveling a lot in the UK, and I couldn't find organic food or healthy food. And, you know, it was the sleep suffered and things like that. So eventually I got out of music, and then I started my fashion school of style 10 years ago, actually this year, and started training people how to do that. So I became an entrepreneur. I dropped out of high school. I don't have any education. I know nothing about business. I just taught myself and just figured it out. And, had a good idea at a good time. And that business is still going. And really is my kind of my main secure source of income as I build my podcast and my own brand that's, catching up. But yeah, that's still going. And then 2 years ago, I retired from being a stylist and started my podcast. And then that's kind of the next part of the journey.
From pain to purpose, man. That's my, I always tell my docs, who I'm working with, look for your purpose in your pain. Man, here you are, man, living out your purpose. There's no doubt. Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, it started when you were sick. I mean, pursuing health, became part of your healing, really. I mean, that's what led you to the things you were able to do. Let's dig in there. I mean, what were some of the, I want to know everything that worked, man. I want to know everything that worked. You've been around the planet, right? You, like me, we resonate. I love looking at ancient cultures for answers, right? I mean, I'm a good study reader too, right? But I'm going to tell you, I find probably even better answers when I look at the ancient cultures, what they did. You've had opportunities to travel the world, look at some of these things. I want to know what you found that worked, that stuck. Because when I would love for people to ask me that answer, because what I teach is what stuck, right? I've been introduced to many things. I've saw many things, tried many things. I have a group of doctors that I try things. But what sticks is what I know works. What stuck, man? What stuck? I mean, you're a phenomenon. I mean, you really are. You're a 1%er, not even a 3%er. So what stuck?
Well, I love the pain to purpose. I don't know if I've ever heard it phrased that way, but I think that first you have to have the motivation. And for most of us, whether it be spiritual pursuit or physical health or any part of sort of personal improvement or development, I meet very few people that just go, you know what, I could probably do better. Usually it takes a point of being motivated. So I was highly motivated when I got sober, because I was 26 and I felt like I was 86. The first things that I did, which is, it's funny that, you specialize in detox as one of your primary areas of focus, because I found a guy named Dr. Richard Schultz, who's a famous American herbalist. He's got a company called American Botanical Pharmacy to this day. And he was a big proponent of fasting. he was a big proponent of colon health.
Yep.
And so, and saunas. And so the first thing I did really to get into this was I started doing, you know, 7-day fast. I think I did a 21-day fast at some point. I became a vegetarian, which is another story that didn't end up panning out for me, but I did that for a number of years. I was eating a really inflammatory diet, unbeknownst to me. But this is the 90s, too. I mean, there, people didn't know about paleo and stuff like that. So
yeah.
I kind of, on the food thing, just to digress a little bit, what happened to me during that time was there started to become a public awareness in the health scene about factory farms and the antibiotics and, like, all the toxic meat industry. There was very little awareness about, you know, going to the farmer's market and grass-fed meat and ghee and healthy fats and all that kind of stuff. So the logical choice was like, well, meat is all bad for you, so we better just stop all meat. And I didn't, you know, and there's, you know, metals in the fish and all that kind of stuff. So I didn't know there was a place in the middle there, which I eventually found where you can eat animal products and be healthy. So unfortunately, in the beginning years, I was still eating a lot of corn and soy and wheat and these inflammatory foods that I really avoid like the plague now. But anyway, back to what work that I still do. It was the fasting, the detoxing, doing liver purges, gallbladder flushes, you know, specific organ cleansing that I learned mostly from Dr. Schultz at the time. He worked a lot with just wildcrafted American herbs and things like that.
And by the way, I believe all of these, like, detox is critical for addiction. And I feel like in the addiction world, they look at detox as, you know, lock you in a room and keep you away from the drug. And, oh yeah, your body detoxes, no doubt. But it goes beyond. The detox really goes beyond that. I mean, you don't get rid of the, you know, that true addiction and craving until you get rid of the toxins that have bioaccumulated in your flesh, because your body's still tasting it, feeling it. There's neurological pathways that are still craving it. You have to get empty the bucket, so to speak, and then you have to re-neurologically pattern, man. And all the stuff that you're going to talk about, man, is all part of that, you know?
You're so right. And that's the thing from the model of, like, a drug treatment center, the terminology they use is like, oh, we're putting you in detox, you're going to detox. But really what they're doing in most cases is giving you drugs to get off the drugs.
Yeah.
It's not like, I mean, now you have your fancy rehabs in Malibu where they do yoga and meditation and sound baths and do all kinds of physical cleanses. And I'm sure they've come a long way, but yeah, when I was in rehab, it's like you just went in there cold turkey and that was your detox. But yeah, what you're talking about with the cellular detox and really getting all that stuff out was absolutely crucial. Interesting story really quick is I recently was having just some physical issues last year. A lot of stuff that I had discovered through some lab tests that I had going on in my gut, just co-infections and all kinds of nastiness, which I cleared up with an herbal protocol. But I thought, well, while I'm at it, I want to do a deep cleanse. And so I did this sort of adapted L. Ron Hubbard niacin sauna. 30.
I know of it. Yeah.
And I did it to the letter, super hardcore. By the end of the 30 days, I was up to like 3,000 milligrams of niacin. And I set myself on a schedule. I'm pretty good at compliance at this point. But what was interesting is when I read the Scientology, you know, the original book that cleanse was taken from, even though I'm not a Scientologist by any stretch, they use it in their Narcanon program to get people off drugs. It's actually a true detox, not just we're going to take you off heroin and give you some barbiturates to get you off heroin. Like, they get people off drugs by what the method that you're saying, like getting it all out of the system. And in that book, it's written in the 70s or something. So the languaging is really sort of antiquated, but they said, you know, and watch out if you've done a lot of psychedelics, when you release those molecules from your fat cells, which is what the niacin sort of does, it explodes. Right. So they said you could have like an acid flashback or something. I'm like, I've been sober 21 years. There's no way that's going to happen. And one night, about 2-3 weeks into that cleanse, I did my thing that day, took my sauna, whatever, and then I went to bed and I was laying in bed and I started tripping out, having this like kind of like lucid dream. I wasn't asleep, I wasn't awake, but this is really strange. I wouldn't say go so far as to, it would be an exaggeration to say I was hallucinating, but I was definitely having an altered state of consciousness randomly out of the blue. And I thought, what the hell is going on? I'm really tripping out right now. And then the next day I thought, you know what? Wow. I bet I did set free some of those, those molecules that have been bound up however many years ago and turn them loose into my bloodstream and felt a little bit funky.
Yeah, no, that's why I always tell it's not months, it's years for detox. That stuff is that deep, man. That's a proof positive. You know, I have to tell you, I'll embarrass myself and tell my story, right? So I was in Jamaica, and you know, I wasn't the drug interest kid, you know, and my friends were more than I, but yet they convinced me to go to Mrs. Brown's famous mushroom omelet place, right? I went. So it's a public place, right? It's a public place. How bad could the mushroom? They said, oh, yeah, you'll laugh. It'll be fine. So it's a public place. So, you know, I ate the omelet. But the problem was, is my girlfriend, I ate half of hers because I was really hungry. You know, I didn't think of this as a drug, right? I'm in a mushroom omelet place and it's famous. And then I also drank the tea, the mushroom tea. So the bottom line is 30 minutes later, I didn't feel anything. 40 minutes later, you know, I literally went through like every one of my personalities. I mean, as I recall it, it became a funny thing and it went to a really scary thing. And I'll just say it that way. I won't supply you. If you know me personal, ask me for the details, but it was not good. I think I could have killed myself. But here's my point really is that as I started detoxing later, not from that, but from mercury and other heavy metals, I felt some of those symptoms, man. I dug into some of those toxic chemicals, and arguably those are natural chemicals, but they had bioaccumulated, man, in my brain. And when I got to a brain phase and I started getting it out, I felt some of that. It was really freaky to me. And I realized what was happening. You know, I was digging into some of those chemicals. So, I mean, it just shows you how this stuff, every toxin from years in our life is bioaccumulated, you know, in our flesh, man, in our deep tissue, in our deep cells. Today, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, EMFs. You've become an expert in this area as well. I mean, grounding, EMFs, blue light. These are all kind of new toxins today. You know, kids are taking probably more drugs and more toxic drugs than ever. And then they're also getting exposed to this and even a chemical glyphosate. Talk a little bit about that, because that became something that stuck for you, right? I mean, these are changes that you did. You're talking about them. So those are things that stuck too. So talk about some of those.
Sure. So moving on after, you know, just getting rid of old residual toxins through fasting and colon cleansing and saunas and all of that kind of stuff, then moving into more modern times and recent discoveries was, you know, in a similar way that you're talking about the ancient cultures and looking like, how did we get here and who were the healthiest cultures? I haven't even gone that deep into the Weston Price stuff and all of that. It's just, I look at things from a very nature-based, holistic, simplistic point of view. I'm not really science-minded. I'm very sort of broad scope, zoomed out. So I just look at a couple different things, all right? A, let's just talk about light. You know, I've interviewed Jack Cruz a couple times. And, you know,
I did too.
He goes very scientifically, really deep into the light. And to me, it's like, that's interesting to a certain type of mind. I don't need to know all that. I just need to look at how we've evolved. So the blue light issue is very simple. Up until the incandescent bulb, the 1870 something, I think, is when we started using artificial light. Up until that point, you got to think about couple hundred thousand years, or you could arguably say a couple million years, however long, you know, this version of the human has been around, the only light we see at night is starlight, moonlight, and firelight. And so that's how we got here. And so the body is designed, the eye, the brain, everything in your biology is designed to go dark or to go red or amber once the sun goes down. But with the modern convenience of artificial lighting, and even some of that artificial lighting be extremely artificial because the color spectrum is so narrow as compared to the sun. Of course, the sun has a, you know, a rainbow spectrum of light frequencies in it, right?
Perfect balance.
Yeah. So everything in nature is created by the creator, whatever that means to you. And so anytime we deviate from creation, there's going to be destruction. And that's how I just look at things in a very simple, like grassroots.
Me too, approach. Man. I look at it that way too.
So I started looking at the light thing and I thought, how can I adapt my, you know, and then this science started coming out to back that up. That's, you know, has to do with melatonin and neurotransmitters and hormones and all that stuff that your audience, I'm sure, has heard about. And if not, can geek out with someone like you or Jack Cruz that can really give you some more of the science. To me, it's just like, so if it gets dark outside and I'm in my home, or I'm out, how can I mimic what's going on outside while still harnessing the conveniences such as incandescent lighting, indoor lighting, devices, computers, et cetera. So a couple of things that I've done to mitigate that are as follows. I wish we could turn the camera around in my place here, but when I moved into this apartment, I really wanted to biohack it. So what I did for the lighting is I have essentially in every room, there's two sets of lighting. There's daytime lighting that is a full spectrum incandescent bulbs that I managed to find.
And where do you buy them? Because I...
On Amazon. If you search for, I forget the brand name offhand, but if you just go on Amazon and you search full spectrum incandescent bulbs, you'll find these lights that have the full range that the sun has. And they're ones that keep you awake and alert. Yeah. They use them sometimes for seasonal affective disorder. So they're like daytime bulbs. If you live in Scandinavia, you use these during the day because it's dark all the time. So if I want lighting during the day, I've got bright, full spectrum bulbs, but you know, I have a decent amount of sun. I'm in LA. But the real key is I have another set of light switches or lamps in the house that are all amber or red bulbs. So I just kind of have habituated myself to hit certain switches after dark. And there's certain switches that I just don't hit. So in my bathroom, for example, there's one overhead, really nasty, like blue LED that's in the fan. Sometimes I need to see though, but I just know at night I just hit the other button that has the vanity lights that are two orange bulbs. It looks kind of weird at first. It takes a little getting used to, but now the whole house turns nice and golden, amber, or red at night. And that's been incredible for my sleep. And it's also something that people really notice when they come over. They're like, wow, your place is so chill. It's so relaxing. They don't know why, but their nervous system starts to tone down. They start to produce melatonin. They stop producing cortisol. I mean, they don't know the mechanisms of action, but they just go, God, it feels really good in here. It's really good energy. I'm like, yeah, it's because I'm not recreating noontime sun at 11 p.m. when we come back from dinner.
It's true. So we were sitting in our living room last night, right? And at night, we never use the overhead lights, right? We use the lamps that have the better bulb.
Right.
And again, I every night I'll stand in front of my Jews light, which is the red.
Oh, I got one right here. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, it kind of resets you, right? You know, for your whole biochemistry for bed. And anyway, so I had, for whatever reason, we were looking for something. Anyways, those lights got on. And my son looked around, he's like, God, I hate these lights. I'm like, yeah, it's like, this is a bad, you know, I gave him the example. He's like, cause he was telling how he feels, right? It's like, gosh, it feels so cold. It feels so, you know, it was feel. And I'm like, yeah, because there's a frequency, there's a wavelength that's not normal there. And that's why I keep those off. You know, it's like, I don't ever use those things. They just happened to go on for, you know, whatever reason last night,
yeah.
You know, but I'm telling you, it's like those lights, man, they make you feel a certain way. And my son, who knew none of the science or, you know, didn't even care to know the science, said, I don't like these lights. You know, it's like, and
he felt like that.
Like, yeah, that's why they're never on.
that's amazing. God, that's, he's so fortunate to have a dad like you that's conscious of some of these things, you know?
Yeah.
I think once a kid's habituated a certain way, it's probably hard to get them to reverse, especially when they hit the rebellious age, you know?
Yeah. All right. So that's one biohack, man. I mean, yeah. There's other, like, cause then there's the fact, okay, so lights are a big deal. I mean, really, yeah. They really are. And let me tell you something, just to reiterate, you know, kids today, especially, and I tell my wife to stop it too. The screens, you know, I mean, I have protective things called Iris. You can download Iris and I use
Iris.
Yeah. And I use it on, there's one called Flux, but you can use them on your screens. So they give you a protection against the blue light. But still, we don't want to look at these screens right before, you know, a few hours before bed, because it's going to disrupt your melatonin production, you know, and obviously disrupt your delta sleep. And I'll remind my listeners and viewers, it's delta sleep, because you're going to say, well, I get good sleep.
Yeah.
You know, I love the Aura Ring, and I don't have my, I'm waiting for the new one, by the way. And because it actually goes off. You can put it on airplane mode, but
yeah, so anyway. That's the I have mine, but I don't wear it during the day because I don't want Bluetooth hitting my bloodstream.
No. Their new one that you could put it on airplane mode, but it would click itself back on. The new one, because Joe Mercola really just hammered them on. So their new one, it's coming out. I like the style of it better too, but it will stay on airplane mode. So you can wear it all night and then just click it on, take it off, put it, and then download it. And then you can see your results. Cool. So the point being this, you can actually now measure these things. You can do this light thing, you know, is it bull crap or not? Well, do the light thing, you know, and then check your delta sleep, because this stuff interferes with your delta sleep. And in that deep sleep, that's where you recover And that's also where your brain actually detoxes. So there's other purposes for it too. But it's a big deal. And people go, I sleep through the night, I sleep fine. And then you measure your delta sleep and you realize you got 20 minutes of delta sleep. You know, right. That can be a problem, or 5 minutes. And I realized when I got the ring, I realized things I did, you know, no doubt was affecting my delta sleep.
Sure.
That people drink, right? People, you know, if I have over a certain amount of glasses of wine, my delta sleep does this. So that's a motivator for me to stay at one or two glasses, you know.
Right.
So and dry farm wines, I could definitely have a few more of those. But you can test your life and actually watch these parameters change. So lights are one of them, and grounding, dude, is another one. That's another big factor.
Yeah.
That people need to ground, like they're sleeping, their beds. Talk a little bit about that.
I'd love to. I want to just interject one thing. I'm actually pissed that dry farm wines came out after I got sober. I'm
talking about dry farm wines and drinking, and I'm talking to a guy who's sober here. So first of all, I apologize for that.
I know Todd and stuff like that.
I'm going to get to emails going, Dr. Pompa was very insensitive to his year. He really, I'm sorry. I know Luke well enough that we can chat like this.
Listen, I live in Hollywood. People smoke weed like cigarettes here. It doesn't bother me at all. I'm kind of halfway joking. And I'm like, oh, I wish I could just try like good biodynamic, organic, glyphosate-free wine just because it probably tastes amazing. But anyway, I digress. One last thing I want to cover on the lighting that I think would be useful for your audience is there's a company called True Dark, and they make some sunglasses but blue light blocking glasses. And they do something very unique that's really cool is that, I mean, they're not the most stylish, but they really block. They have a few different shades depending on what time of day it is. And they have a really dark red one for the last couple hours before sleep that not only blocks the blue light, but also the green light.
Yeah.
That's the thing with a lot of these cheap like amber glasses or even the amber bulbs. You're still getting a considerable amount of green light, which suppresses melatonin to a degree. What they did that was also unique is they have little inserts in them so you can get prescription lenses put inside, which I think was really smart. But more than anything, what they just put out are these things called, I think they call them panels, and they're essentially like these sheets of red film, like a transparent film that you can get that you can put over any existing lighting fixtures, like overhead fluorescent lighting in your kitchen.
Good point.
Yeah, they're really cool. So I just like to give them a shout out. I interviewed their CEO.
Would you say it again? Say the website again.
True Dark.
True Dark. Yeah, exactly. That's the glasses I have as well. So yeah. I didn't know they had that film though.
Yeah, I interviewed Chris Keene the other day and he told me about it. I was like, oh, this is amazing. I started recommending it to clients and stuff. So that's one intervention that you can do in terms of manipulating the lighting in your office or work is you can actually just get that film and cut it to size. And it's like, say you have recessed lighting in your kitchen and you can't get to those bulbs. You could literally just put film over whatever lighting you want. And you'll also kill the green as well, which is cool. So that's just one last thing on the lighting. The other thing with grounding is, and I'm going to go back to nature, in that we talked about how the cycles of light, the moon and the sun and the earth are all in a certain position that have been put that way by an intelligent force, right? And there's a reason why our biology is corresponding to the solar system. Well, our body is also corresponding to the Earth's magnetic field and to the abundance of free electrons that are present when you touch the Earth. And if you think about every single living sentient creature on the planet since the beginning of time, lives their entire life grounded, with the exception of birds in flight or migration. So when a bird lands in a tree, it's grounded. When a fish or a turtle is in water, it's grounded. When a deer is walking around the forest, it's grounded ad infinitum. You can't give me one example of an animal that's not grounded, because animals don't use rubber shoes and they don't use rubber tired cars, right? We, unfortunately, with the advent of sneakers, which are great and handy, and the advent of cars and elevated living spaces. Oh, look at that puppy.
you talked about grounded animals, and I had to bring her out.
Device right there.
She hasn't been on Cell TV in a long time, so this is good.
I love dogs. I was thinking about getting one. You know what I heard on that note, and I don't know if this is true or just some woo-woo stuff, but I read somewhere that your animals actually pick up a negative charge when they're outside, and they carry it, and that when you pet your animals, you get grounded. Please, someone scientifically qualified look into that for me. Because
yeah, I don't know. I haven't looked into that.
Definitely feel really good when you touch an animal. You know, like when you pet a dog, is it just the love or is there something, you know, biochemical or electric going on?
I always say I get an oxytocin boost.
Yeah.
Oxytocin is the love hormone, right? It's the feel good hormone and the love hormone. So when I touch my puppies, man, I get the boost of oxytocin. So there you go.
That's great.
I even talk different.
I know, I do that too. When I talk to dogs, I talk to them like a baby. You know, I'm like, hey, puppy.
Yeah, you can't help it.
But back to the grounding thing. So let's just apply common sense. So if all creatures, human and otherwise, spend their entire life electrically grounded to the planet in one way or another, then nature must have made this whole thing up to be that way. If I live in a second story apartment in LA, or I live in the 54th floor in New York City, wherever I am, I'm disconnected from the health benefits of the earth. And so I don't want to go live out in the forest and sleep on the ground. I like living in a nice apartment. I like driving my BMW around with rubber tires. I'm really into the convenience. I love my cell phone, my computers. I love technology. I'm a huge tech geek. So what I've done to mitigate that is I have little grounding pads. In fact, my foot's been on one. I went away from the mic there for a minute. I can't quite get it to reach the camera, but my bare foot's been on my grounding pad for the entire conversation. I have a very narrow little panel that my feet touch that is on my bed that's plugged in to the ground outside my bedroom window. I literally ran a ground wire with a copper spike, drilled it into a wet piece of dirt behind my apartment building, and I'm grounded electrically while I sleep.
Isn't that the best way? I mean, there's other grounding mats, but I mean, when you truly run the wire out the window, you know, and that's what I've heard is the best.
I mean, you know, it's funny. I talk to a lot of EMF experts. Some of them think grounding is BS. Some of them think it's great. You could talk to 10 PhD, you know, physicists, electricians, you know, whatever. They're all going to give you a different answer. To me, I'm just going with nature. I'm going to do whatever I can. So yeah, I would prefer to have a ground wire going outside into the actual ground. That said, it could be argued that there's dirty electricity in the ground in Los Angeles because there's freaking electricity running all through in between houses and apartments because it's just so densely populated, there's some bad wiring, et cetera. I'm still going to just opt for the best possible option, and that's to be grounded. Second option, like the one that I have my foot on now, is just in the ground plug in the outlet of the wall, which I'm presuming that this building is wired correctly so that that outlet is grounded, and there's actually a ground wire going down into the earth underneath the foundation.
There is, yeah.
And actually, I've tested the outlets in here, and they are, in fact, properly grounded. Every once in a while, you get in a really old building, and it only has the little two-prong plug. You don't have the opportunity to ground there. So if I'm sitting in the living room, I have a little pad. I have one on my bed. I have one on my computer. I've taken it a step further, and I've grounded my car. There's a lot of EMF and also just time and space drag when you're in a car or an airplane, for that matter, where you're traveling through time and space faster than you're meant to, essentially, and you pick up static electricity, and then you also pick up static electricity and a positive charge from the interior of your car, from all the electronics, the seat heaters, all that crap. So what I did is I got this grounding strap. It's called a Mitzer, M-I-T-Z-E-R. I believe you get them on Amazon. It's called a Mitzer, and it's a conductive rubber strap. It's about maybe 12 to 15 inches long, about an inch wide. You get that by a mechanic wired to the frame of your car, because the frame of your car is grounded to your battery. When that grounding strap is touching concrete or dirt or something other than asphalt, your car is actually electrically grounded. And what's weird is that they use them on city buses and different utility vehicles to improve gas mileage. It's really bizarre. Because I don't know how it works. It's, you know, it's beyond my capacity for reason. But I've seen them on buses. And then I started inquiring and said, oh, yeah, it's for gas mileage because it keeps the battery grounds to the concrete, you know, to the street. So then I have a little conductive wrist strap that's been wired to the frame of my car underneath my seat. And that's connected to the battery, too. So unless I'm on asphalt when I'm driving around, I'm actually grounded, too. It might be in my head and a placebo thing, but I swear to God, I get less fatigue driving around when I'm grounded than when I'm ungrounded.
What about flying? Because I mean, it arguably being jet lag, arguably is part of, it's part of the jet lag story, really.
I mean, yeah. So with that, I've heard Mercola and Jack Cruz both talk about, you know, when you're in a seat and you have the opportunity to put your bare feet on a metal seat, like in front of you, that you're grounded to the grounded electrical system in the plane. So at least you're grounded to their system. You're not just free floating and picking up that static electricity. Obviously, a plane isn't, because I've had people call me out on social media, you idiot, how can a plane be grounded? I go, I know it's not grounded, but the electrical system is grounded to itself, however that works. Now, what I do, because I'm really particular about flying, and I'm just tall, and I have back problems. I can't sit in a coach seat. I'm not trying to be like fancy, but I'll literally just wait to take a trip until I can get at least business, if not first class. It's just,
yeah.
I'm 47. I can't be sitting in the back of the plane. I just can't do it. And I really have a hard time with travel fatigue. So the seats that I fly in never have a metal seat that I can touch with my foot. It's too far away. Usually they're covered by plastic in those nicer seats anyway. So what I did is I plugged my little grounding wrist strap. It's called an anti-static wrist strap. You can get those on Amazon also. There's also a great site called lessemf.com.
I use it. Yeah, I use it all the time. Yeah.
So I actually plug into the outlet, to the ground plug in the outlet at my seat. Now, I talked to Jack Cruz about that. He's a really bright guy. And he's like, oh, you're insane. You shouldn't do that. You're going to pick up more EMFs than you disperse from your body. I don't know. I still like it, so I'm still doing it. The verdict is out on the plane grounding. But I just followed my intuition, and it makes sense to me that if I can at least be grounded to the plane itself, that's better than just free-floating at however many hundred miles an hour, 35,000 feet up. So for the grounding stuff, I've hit it pretty hard, and I'm still waiting for more research. I think why I opted for it instead of against it with the grounding is, like, right here sitting in front of this microphone and my big iMac computer and my preamp and everything, if I had an EMF meter that was a skin voltage meter, I'd be off the charts. The minute I put one pinky toe on my grounding mat, it goes to zero.
Yeah. How do you argue with that?
So the argument against my theory of grounding is that what's happening is the electrical charge that's coming off of my computer is finding me as a human ground, and it's using me as a conduit to get itself grounded into the earth under my apartment building. That's one school of thought. The other school of thought, which I tend to lean more toward, is that the field that's coming from the earth upward, coming up under the building into my grounding pad and up through my body, is actually pushing the EMFs away from me. And that's why my field goes to zero with the skin voltage meter. In other words,
couldn't you take, I have the TES 593. You know, it's my EMF meter.
Yeah.
Couldn't you take that? I've never done it. I should try. You just gave me the idea, but take it and see if the EMF drops.
If you have the skin voltage meter, you can literally, like, you can put your, like I said, your pinky toe on a grounding sheet or a grounding mat, and it'll go to zero. Whereas,
I'm just wondering, even if it's pushing back, like you said.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, pushing back the EMF to the device. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you could literally measure that. I never thought to do that.
This is a constant, this is one piece of the grounding, the EMF thing that literally every guy I talk to, that they're brilliant people, they all have a polarized opinion.
Well, you know, it's because it's new science. I mean, you know, I think we're all discovering. In the last couple of years, I've been digging into this myself, and I'm kind of a slow adapter. With certain things, you know, I'm definitely that person who has to be convinced. And I'm the person who not just, I can read the science, but then I have to feel the feel that I have to see. You know, luckily, like you, I mean, I'm around a large group of people that, you know, we have a ability to try different things. And again, it's what sticks, right? I mean, you know, this is working, this isn't, you know, so study's one thing, but, you know, what becomes real? Like you, I'm always asking people, you know, I'm very curious. Before, when I'm convinced, man, I'm convinced, I'm full in, you know, but getting me totally convinced is another story.
I think for me, like I said, it's just common sense. You look at the blue light thing, you look at the solar cycle. Oh, I'm just going to follow the solar cycle. Like, it's a no-brainer. When you look at grounding, we're meant to be touching the planet or a body of water or a plant or something and being electrically grounded. So why not stay like that? It's just very broad strokes.
We're really testing our bodies today. I mean, it's, flexibility or adaptability is a better word, is everything with health, finding homeostasis to even take it more scientific. But, that is the testimony to health. We can, the better the life we live, the more toxic free or interference free that we are, the better our bodies can adapt, right? So therefore, people can say, well, I'm exposed to these lights and, I'm still very healthy. Well, your body's adapting now. Throw a few other stressors in your life, right? I mean, throw some emotional stressors in your life, throw some more toxic stressors in your life. All of a sudden now, the light that you were adapting to, now your body's not adapting. So you're in bad lights of the day. You go outside, your body has an ability to fix itself. It does. But the moment you lose adaptation ability, now the sickness and the symptoms are coming. And it never starts at that moment. It starts long before when your body stops the adaptation. So the point is to regain health, we have to remove all these things that force our body to adapt. We have to remove as much of it as we can. No matter what, your body's adapting to things. But we want to minimize these massive things that we are able to control, because so much of it, Luke, we're not able to control. So that's the way I live my life. What can I control? Because therefore, the things I can't control, my body will then adapt to. And then therefore, I won't end up having symptoms or worse yet, sickness. Yeah. So that's kind of my thought process with that. Yeah. But go ahead. You were going to say something. I interrupted. Well,
yeah. I mean, and I like that you brought up the word control, because I think in the health space, and specifically with people like me, they're really, to me, biohacking is a hobby. It's a passion. I just love optimizing health. It's an obsession, but it's also just, I just enjoy it. I like the technology, the new gadgets. I'm always finding some new discovery. I could tell you 5 things I found in the past year that have changed my life, and it's exciting. But then there's the other side, like you said, there's certain things that you can't control. And I think that on the other side of it, it's sort of like with dietary obsessions, orthorexia can kick in, where now you're like living in a bubble, and
absolutely,
the neurosis of the fear of being exposed to EMF and blue light, the fear is probably more toxic than the blue light.
I agree.
At a certain point, so as obsessed as I seem to some people, and as extreme as some of my measures are, I also take it with a grain of salt. And dude, I mean, every couple months I'd be driving by a donut shop and I just go, you know what? I'm going to go eat 4 donuts. Just the most toxic gluten, glyphosate, just the worst fats.
It is in my toxic top 5.
I go out to a movie at midnight and it's blue light all over this, place. I mean, I purposefully do things sometimes just to break the mold and get myself out of that controlled, fear-based kind of mindset and just go, you know what? I'm going to die eventually anyway. I just would prefer, as you said, to die healthier, because these things that might not harm me right now, or I might be able to tolerate, are going to be accumulative. And then when I'm 80, I get this mysterious illness. I don't want to get a mysterious illness, because it's been death by 1,000 cuts. So I am going to mitigate some of these things.
Yeah, you will. But
at the end of the day, you also have to live your life,
I'm
so rigid that I'm like a total control freak.
Listen, I agree with you. I totally agree. I live that balance, because it's this too. My diet variation strategy, which, you should have me on your show talking about that. I have a very unique strategy and a very unique take, I should say. And it is a strategy. And it works. Again, it helps people who can't lose weight, lose weight. It helps people who can't get well, get well. So, but I have a really balanced approach with that, with the diet strategy. But I think life with the light and everything, I want to minimize. I don't want my bucket to fill up again. So my thing is minimize it, but stressing about it to that point, that'll fill my bucket too. So I believe that balance. I do. We are living in a different world. Most of my viewers today, they have to get their life back. So therefore, they have to pay attention to these EMFs. They have to pay attention to these things. Look, I just had someone who was found out that they were sleeping next to where they put a darn smart meter on the outside of their house, and they didn't know. And meanwhile, there's someone who's trying to get their life back, and they literally, with me on the phone with them, they went outside. I said, well, if it's analog and moving like click, 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 you're good. If it's digital, you're not, and it's like, I learned, Nicholas, right? His book, he gave it to me, the non-tinfoil guide. I love that, to EMFs, right? It was a great interview, and it was on just a couple interviews here ago. But, he was the one that, reminded my viewers to look at your smart meter. But one of my people did, and it was a smart meter putting out massive EMF, you know, and sure enough, a massive cause, you know, of why they weren't recovering, you know, the way they should. So anyways, bottom line is today, you know, most of my viewers have to pay attention to these things because they have to empty the bucket so their body starts adapting. Luke, who, you know, is a final question here in a wrap up. Number one, remind them how they get in touch, you know, with you, your podcast, but, you know, as kind of a preview to that, who are you interviewing? Like, tell us about your podcast a little bit. Like, I mean, you're such a really interesting guy. You know, you're that guy that's so easy for me to talk to. So you can go on and on. But who are you interviewing, man? What's the focus of your podcast? And then tell them how to get there.
You know, the idea with my podcast is, since I've retired from being a fashion stylist, where you go out and you find this dress and this handbag and this jacket and you kind of put together this amalgam look for someone, I realize that's what I've been doing with my lifestyle for the past 21 years. I find the best, you know, supplement with DHA, and I've optimized the lighting, and all the things that we've talked about is kind of taking bits and pieces of truth and putting them together, along with, you know, the not only the physical but the metaphysical, which is a huge part of my journey and my life and my well-being. Yeah. Is my prayer life, my spiritual life, meditation.
Yeah, huge with me too.
All of that. And so the idea with the show was to take all of the people that I'm a fan of, you being one of them, and to bring all of these voices together from the physical and metaphysical, meaning health field, and also from spirituality and personal development, even just, you know, mindset, which would be more in the personal development. So it's to bring all those people together and sort of translate their message in a way that's very relatable and applicable. So the average person can go, yeah, that kind of makes sense. I never thought about meditating in that way. I'll try it. You know, that's my goal. So I've interviewed a pretty diverse range of people, as long as they qualify for me as someone that helps you build the ultimate lifestyle. And so I've interviewed music mogul Russell Simmons, who's a famous yogi and a meditator, also one of the most, you know, successful entrepreneurs in music. I think I Googled his net worth after the interview. It was like a zillion trillion dollars, you know, just really incredible, prolific guy. Of course, I've interviewed Dave Asprey from Bulletproof. I do a lot of stuff on relationships. I've interviewed John Gray, from the author of Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. Really great information about hormones and just how men and women biologically relate to one another. I interviewed a meditation teacher who's world-renowned, named Sharon Salzberg, who's a big Buddhist meditator and mindfulness teacher. Let me see, who have I done lately that's been exciting? Also, people, you know, I've interviewed people that have a different point of view. Like, I interviewed Rich Roll, who's a big podcaster, who's a vegan triathlete, and mm-hmm. he has a very strong case for that lifestyle, the plant-based lifestyle. So it's not one that I personally follow. It doesn't work for me, but it seems to be working for him and his following. So I've had him on to get that different perspective. And then a lot of people just on psychology like that, so talking about things like NLP and just mindset and how to really get your mind right. My meditation teacher, Jeff Kober, who's kind of like me, has an interesting sort of double life. He's an actor that's been on The Walking Dead and Sons of Anarchy and things like that, but he's also been studying and practicing and teaching Vedic meditation for 20 years, and so we really dive deep into like the actual real practice of meditation. So I try to just reach from both of those worlds. Yeah. I find that a lot of the people that are in the spiritual scene, I would never eat what's on their dinner plate. You know, they're physically not fit.
Isn't it true?
And then you have people that are, you know, really into fitness and biohacking and stuff. And you meet them and they can't even be present or conscious in the conversation because they're too captured up in the intellect and they haven't.
So true, Luke. Yeah.
Have that spiritual connection. So just because it's what I've had to do at first for my own survival as a recovering addict, and then later just having reaped so many rewards of exploring my whole personhood in all of those different areas, I'm attracted to the experts in all of that range as it pertains to adding principles to your life. In other words, finding truths, learning how to apply them, and then not just learning about them so you have an intellectual knowledge or understanding, but then doing it. You know, and I'm sure you understand compliance as a doctor. You know, you can teach someone about something all day long, but will they actually do it? The goal of my show and my whole message is to present things in a way that people can go, yeah, that's actually doable. I can change a few light bulbs. Oh, speaking of light bulbs, one more trick. If you change the lighting in your house and you put in amber and red bulbs, don't forget about the refrigerator. Yeah, because you'll have the whole place red and amber. It's all beautiful. Your melatonin is just cranking after 8. And then you open that fridge, and it's like noon sunlight blasting you in the face. And so what I did is I put an orange LED bulb in my refrigerator. You open it up, and it looks like, you know, the suitcase and the briefcase in Pulp Fiction when they open it up. In this.
Yeah, you know, and maybe that film. You can get that film because some people, I can't get the bulb out. It's under, you know, okay, great. Put the film over it.
Some aren't as easy to change. Yeah, I have a very basic fridge, so mine's just a little round bulb. But, yeah. So things like that is like, you know, someone doesn't have to be, you know, a neuroscientist or a PhD to like get, oh, okay, wow, I can make, when it gets dark outside, it should get dark inside. Basic stuff. But I might have to interview, a very highly intellectual person to be able to convince someone that there is a reason other than just common sense behind that.
Yeah, one of the great tips that Nicholas here, he has a French last name, but he reminded me it's like the wine, like the Pinot, like so Nicholas.
Okay, right.
So when you interview him, Nicholas Pinot, like a Pinot wine, you won't forget. But anyways, I keep bringing wine up to you, man. I'm going to slap myself silly in a minute. All right. Anyway,
it's all good, dude. I mean, I'm not one of the, there are sober people that are really, really strict. I mean, I take CBD that has a little bit of THC in it. I take tinctures that have grape alcohol in them. You know, I know my threshold.
Dude, you're living such a balanced life, man. And first of all, you know, compliments to you, and take my hat off to you because you really are, man. That's why you're so darn successful. And, you know, for me, you've dug out of the, you know, again, you're beyond a 3% or you're a 1%. You know, just, you not only got through the impossible, you know, have taken it, and now you're making a difference in society. But anyways, I thought a great tip that Nicholas gave was putting the Christmas tree light thing, right? You know how you can set it so they go on and off automatically with day and night, or the hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, right?
Yeah.
And you put that on your modem, right?
That's so it does.
Anyone can do that. Why wouldn't you do that, right? It goes on and off automatically, right? It's like, that's brilliant. I mean, more sick people can turn their whole fuse box off, you know, and really – you know, because again, it's about getting deep sleep. It's about really getting REM sleep, Delta sleep, you know? Right. So anyways, you offered some great things too, between these two shows, man. I'll tell you, I think it's more important than ever to biohack, you know, our lives. You know, again, it's, you know, that one thing that you can control. That's just that we're finding out it's a bigger interference, you know, to the way our body runs and heals at the cellular level than we ever thought. So, hey, these are some easy things that everyone can do. So, hey, Luke, thank you, man. You're such an amazing guy. I appreciate you being on the show for our viewers and listeners. And tell them how to get to your podcast again.
Sure. So the podcast is called The Life Stylist. The Life Stylist Podcast. My name is Luke Story. You can find everything that I do at my website, which is lukestory.com. That's S-T-O-R-E-Y. On social media, I think I'm most prolific on Instagram. I also do a lot of really crazy stuff on my Instagram stories, which people enjoy because I know it's going to disappear in 24 hours. So, you know, when I was just in Park City, I live streamed with Dr. Harry Adelson and Dr. Amy Killen. For example, on my social media, it's kind of weird stuff I'll do. I live streamed the whole surgery, like in the operating room. I put up a tripod and I put on Facebook and Instagram, like the gory, I'm under anesthesia and I just let the cameras roll and they're
I'm going to be doing the same thing. Actually, I'm interviewing Harry and so I'm going to share the audience, you know, with some of the, you know, the stem cell. I've been after it now for, you know, a couple years, especially the last year, I would say. And, oh my gosh, you know, I just, my interest in, and Harry, man, you found the best. You know, Harry's incredible.
Those Seri clinics, they were great, man. And it was what was fun is they're modernized in terms of their understanding of media and marketing and stuff. So I don't know how many people would just be like, yeah, cool, go ahead and set up your Instagram, all your cameras and stuff in the corner and let it run. You know,
I know, right?
They were like, the doctor let you do that? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, I'm promoting his business. He's not dumb, you know, and he's cool. Yeah. There's nothing unsanitary about it or illegal or anything like that. But I think
he realizes the benefit, right? Amy Killen, I interviewed her on this show, and we talked about Gainswave, you know, erectile dysfunction, and we went into the stem cells. And, you know, my wife won't do Botox. I treat people that, you know, are toxic from it. And You know, yeah, who wants their face not to move? But, you know, anyways, the stem cell is the way to go. I'm going to film that as well. So, but he does the whole body stem cell makeover. For me, he's doing something no one else is doing. So I can't wait for the show, and I can't wait to get done too. So anyways,
ask him about, I'm sure he's going to do it anyway, but he did something on me that's relatively new called, I think they're called exosomes. Has he talked to you about that?
No, I know Harry very well. I sit down with him tomorrow, actually, ironically.
Awesome. I'm sure.
Exosomes.
Yeah, it's, I can't even begin to explain it. He explained it to me and I just kind of nodded like I knew what he was talking about, but it's sort of this cutting edge new element to the stem cell treatment that was pretty cool. I was one of the first people he did it on. And
I'm glad it's in on you first. I might be the second.
I'm still standing. Yeah. I mean, it's just been 2 weeks since I was out there, but yeah, Amy did my face, my scalp, my genital region. And then he did my shoulder, my hip, two discs and my SI joint. So I'm excited. I've had back pain for going on probably 25 years, you know, so I've tried everything. I'm really hopeful about this one.
Yeah, you know, Harry said, look, anywhere I've ever had a damage or function, even if it's not bothering me now, I'm hitting it, right? I mean, he puts you under. So y'all wait, you're going to get to see it, right? I'm videotaping the whole thing, man. It's like, you're going to see something that really, I think no one else is doing it like him, but I think it's massively, it's the future. I think it's just absolutely incredible. For people who just want to be healthier and people trying to get their health back. So stay tuned for that. Luke, man, thank you. Gosh, you and I could just talk all day. You better hook up with me next time you're in Park City. I'm going to get your back.
I had no idea you lived out there. I thought you lived back east or something. I would have totally.
That was years ago. I lived in Pittsburgh. But Park City, man, it's a hop, skip, and a jump for you. So.
You know, it's a short flight from LA, so I'm definitely going to be back. I loved it. You know, you're kind of burnt out on the cold. For me, the snow was like, I was like in heaven, like, oh my God. I was out with my shirt off at the Salt Lake City airport. It was 37 degrees. I was out there in the sun, walking barefoot in the snow, doing my Wim Hof breathing before I got on the plane. Salt Lake City was not ready for my ass. People were walking by like, what? I was loving it, man. It was great.
Yeah, the snow. Yeah, we should. I'm looking outside right now. Looking. I don't want to unplug here, but I don't know if you can get. I'm gonna unplug my thing. Can you see that?
That's gorgeous, man.
All right. Well, anyways, thank you, Luke. Appreciate you, man. And we're gonna see you on the other side of Park City next time.
Thanks, see you guys. Man.